Hi, everyone. You're listening to another episode of the Style Files podcast. I'm your host, Paloma Contreras, and joining me today is one of my favorite interior designers, Markham Roberts. Based in New York City, designer Markham Roberts has been called a master of timeless American style by Vogue. He's earned the reputation as one of the top decorators of his generation and has been repeatedly named to the AD 100 by Architectural Digest, as well as to the Elle Decor A-list. His first book, Decorating the Way I See It, was published in 2014 by Vendome Press, and his newest book, Notes on Decorating, was recently published this fall, also by Vendome Press. Known for his creativity and his ability to work in a variety of styles, Markham adeptly interprets his clients' needs and wants to seamlessly reflect their style and not merely his own imprint. Whether working on commercial projects or for private clients across the country and abroad, Markham infuses interiors with his sophisticated and personal touch, applying his knowledge and experience individually and specifically to each project. According to Senga Mortimer, the noted editor, there is a distinct refinement that runs through all of his work and is indeed emblematic of his personality. Markham, with his unflinching ease, his assured eye, his natural understanding of how a house should function, and his total lack of pretense, creates rooms that are timeless. Markham, we're so excited to welcome you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Paloma. I'm fine. Thank you. I hope you're well, too.
I'm doing well. You know, all things considered, I feel like making the best of it and just trying to get to 2021 at this point.
Good luck, right?
Yeah. I feel like this year has just been a doozy and it keeps just dragging on. I'm sure we're all ready for a new year and a fresh start.
Yep. We'll make it.
So where have you been this whole time? Are you in the city or are you elsewhere?
I am not in the city. I have been, since March when all hell broke loose, we came up to our house in the Hudson Valley. And mm-hmm. I had redone the carriage house on the property as a studio to work from. And I'd been already trying to spend more time up in the country and, you know, maybe two or three nights a week in the city. So I was all set up basically to work from here. And, you know, when we left in March, we thought it might be a couple of weeks. We didn't really know what was going on. But I was able to just, you know, hit the ground running working from here. And that was fine. I did have to, at one point, you know, get some books and samples and things from my library in the office. But other than that, it was quite an easy transition. So I was lucky. And it's been very nice to be in the country.
That's good to hear.
Yeah. I have been back in the city and the city is terrific. I started to go back early, for one night a week or if I had meetings and things. You know, there's a lot you can do remotely, but there's a mm-hmm. lot you can't do as a decorator. You can't sit in a sofa and feel the comfort. You can't really approve a paint sample without really being there. It's not a Zoom thing.
Right. That's so true.
So I have been going back to the city and I have to say the city seems great to me. So I think that's something to look forward to. I mean, I am very lucky to get to work in New York, one of the most interesting places in the world. And I am happy to see it seemingly thriving. Yes, we are all facing difficulties. But things seem very good to me, so that's nice.
Well, that's really nice perspective and great to hear as someone who doesn't live in New York, but is there frequently and loves the city. And, you know, I have a lot of friends and resources and a lot of things that I love in New York. So it's nice to hear from a New Yorker that things are looking up and, you know, the city's still there. It's not going anywhere and things may look a little bit different moving forward, but I'm glad to hear that the spirit, perseveres and is still there. Yeah. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Midwest. I am from Indianapolis. My father is from New York City, and my mother's family came from Indiana and lived in Indianapolis, and I grew up there. And I love that city. I was very happy growing up there. I went away to school when I was 14, but So I haven't lived there in a long time permanently, but my family's there, and that's what I think of as home, to be honest. Even though I've lived in New York much longer now that I'm so long in the tooth, I still love Indianapolis. I love the Midwest. It makes me very happy.
Do you feel that living and growing up in the Midwest influenced your aesthetic or your point of view as a decorator in any way?
Sure. You know, I think whatever exposure we have informs us later on. And I think I talked about this in my first book a little bit. We grew up, I grew up in a, you know, brick Tudor style house on sort of the main street of the city. And it was one of those, you know, great American houses from the 20s that had, you know, an amalgam of different styles going on. The exterior was Tudor, but the interior had sort of a Georgian paneled library, and the dining room had a Georgian mantle and other architectural details. The library, the entry hall and the living room were sort of more classic French. It was a nice sort of mixture, like Americans are, of all different influences. And so I think that, you know, knowing that house, and then later in my childhood moving, you know, teenage years to a house far north, everybody sort of left the city and moved to the suburbs for whatever reason. And, you know, my parents got a nice big house with a beautiful yard and garden. But it was, you know, a house that had been built in the 60s by probably a builder who was freely mixing styles without any real knowledge of what they were. And so I think knowing those two different houses and experiencing, you know, a beautiful old house, a new house that didn't have real architectural integrity. And then my parents moved to a third house that had been built by an architect who really studied French Norman houses. And it was a new house, newly built house, but with beautiful materials and with knowledge behind it. And so I then saw how you could actually do that and achieve what they had done in the 20s and 30s, you know, between the wars. And it really showed me, it made me love old houses. It made me love craftsmanship. It made me love materials. We also, I was lucky to get to, we would go to Florida in the winter to visit my grandmother, and, you know, to know what a house is in a tropical climate on the water is nice and informative, certainly later on in my career. And then, of course, we would go to Michigan in the summers, and, you know, a lake house in the woods is very different from a suburban house or a house on the Gulf of Mexico. And it was great to see that. My grandmother had a, you know, everybody there, the cottages in the place where we went were sort of charming and quirky, or they were those sort of log, I don't want to say log cabins, but they looked like they were built of Lincoln logs. They were these giant, you know, piles of Lincoln logs. And then there were sort of interesting modern houses. My grandparents had one of the old big Lincoln log houses that was painted gray and really charming, beautiful. And then in the 40s, they built a modern house with the interior completely paneled in pine, ceilings, floors, and walls, with big windows out on the lake. And so to, I think, experience modern or mid-century modern at the, and the old-fashioned, quirky, charming, cottagey stuff together really helped me understand different things for my career later on, even though I had no idea what I was going to do or anything like that.
Right. So it sounds like from a young age, you were really observing your surroundings and being mindful about architecture, and sort of, it sounds like the houses that you grew up in really had an influence over developing, I guess, an eye or
I think
interest in design or architecture.
Yes. I would like to think that. I was probably a kid who was picking my nose and skipping stones and just soaking it up subliminally. So I don't think I was really, I wish to think that I was cognizant of it, but I think I probably wasn't. But again, influence can come from many different arenas, and conscious or otherwise, it's there.
That's very true. I feel like that's probably the case for most of us, where, of course, as children, you don't necessarily realize that this is what you're going to do with your life in the future. Or, you know, I don't know of any 8-year-olds that are drafting or doing floor plans. I mean, unless you have some sort of prodigy. But it's interesting to your point that it's sort of the subliminal influence that you may not realize at the time, but looking back as an adult, when you think about the interests that you had as a kid or the things that you remember that are really striking in your memory for whatever reason, that they would sort of pop up in your adulthood and influence what you dedicate your life to in such a strong way.
Yeah.
So at what point then did you realize this is what I want to be doing with my life?
I'm slow to the game. I didn't know what I wanted to do until I'd started working for Mark Hampton. I should have known. I was always interested in, I liked pretty houses. I liked architecture. I liked museums and travel and art. I liked all of this stuff that you would think would have clued me into the fact that I might be interested in design, but I didn't. And I think that's probably the folly of youth, maybe. I thought, you know, out of college, I wasn't really thinking that much. And I thought auction houses or advertising could be super interesting and fun, which I'm sure it could have been. But I landed a job with Mark Hampton through a family friend, a lovely lady who was a friend of my grandmother's. And he had worked for her, done her house in Hope Sound, and worked a little bit in Indianapolis with her. And she wrote a letter to him saying that he should meet me when I moved to New York. And I didn't know that she had done this. And then I met him by chance. And he's like, well, I just got a letter about you. So it was kind of a funny circumstance. But the minute I started working for him, I knew immediately that I was doing what I should be doing. I mean, immediately. And so again, I think I was just slow. So.
Yeah. Well, that's incredible that it clicked once you were in that environment, surrounded by what I can only imagine was an incredible formative experience to have worked under someone like Mark Hampton. What do you remember from that time? What do you think are the biggest lessons that you still carry with you from that time?
You know, it was a great place to work. He was terrific. He was, fantastically generous. He was super knowledgeable. He was, just great. And I can't underestimate how lucky I was to know him and to have experienced his mentorship, I guess. I learned, we were exposed to everything. I mean, we got to work on the most interesting projects. And I remember my first 2 days of work, he took me around, took me to Ann Bass's apartment. He took me to the Steinbergs' apartment, and he took me to the Burdens' apartment to show me, sort of what was going on. And, I was just blown away. But I think I learned more than anything how hard you have to work to do this and how thoughtful you have to be, how practical and on top of it you have to be. I mean, the job of decorator is many, many hats. It's so much more than picking out fabrics.
Isn't that the truth?
Mark would spend the week traveling and meeting with clients, and he would spend the weekends many of the times going through notes that we prepared for him and responding to our questions. And it was a lot. And I learned how hard you have to work. And, watching him have fun at it, when he's with clients, when he's installing and when he's out looking at things, he would take me to the museum to look at things. He would send me up to the Met to sketch a chair or something like that. I realized how fun it could be, but I also realized how serious a job it is and how hard you have to work.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. So, so true. I mean, I don't know that the average person who hasn't either worked in the design world or worked with a decorator for their own home, even our clients, I don't know that they always realize, because it's sort of our job to keep them from knowing all of the millions of things that happen, all of the different puzzle pieces that have to fit together in order to get to the installation and have everything run smoothly. But I think anyone listening who has worked as a designer or in the design field knows that there are a million different things to keep up with and so many things that can go wrong. And as you said, so many hats to wear, not only from a creative perspective, but from the business side of things. And then everything in between from, you know, family therapist, psychologist, housekeeper, everything. It runs the gamut.
Pet trainer.
Yes. Literally everything.
People have no idea. They think that we go out to lunch and have fun and shop for some pillows and put them in and it's have a drink and it's a fun day. And it's just not that at all.
No, definitely not. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are definitely parts of this career that are incredibly fun. And there are, you know, glamorous moments if we get to go to an event and being around other creatives, that's all wonderful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, getting to travel and training one's eye and all of that. Those are the most amazing parts of it. But what people don't always realize is the sleepless nights when you wake up in the middle of the night and are thinking about X, Y, and Z and when it's shipping and when it's arrived or something arrived damaged or a certain client didn't seem as thrilled about something when you presented it as you'd hope they would. There's just so many different things. And I feel like we carry a lot of weight on our shoulders in order to, you know, create this sort of vision. Yes. To make this, I hate to say dream come true. That sounds so cheesy and trite, but to really bring this vision to life for a client.
No, I agree.
You know, it takes a lot of effort.
Yeah.
So at what point did you decide it was time to go out on your own after working under Mark Hampton?
So I worked for Mark for just under 6 years. And at the age of 30, you know, I wanted to do my own thing. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was a very difficult decision. It wasn't scary or anything like that, but I was terribly nervous to come to Mark and to tell him that I wanted to go do my own thing because I thought I'd be letting him down. And I remember going into his office and, you know, it was always busy at the office and he was always traveling and doing stuff. And I just said to him, I know you're leaving today. You come back over the weekend. I said, will you just let me know if there's a time next week when we can sit down and talk? There's something I want to talk to you about. And he smiled and he looked at me and he said, I know exactly what you want to tell me and I don't want you to worry about it. It's fine. He's like, let's go to lunch next week and we can talk about it. But he's like, it's okay. And that was the kindest thing that he could possibly have done for me at the time. And he was so, you know, we went to lunch and he's like, okay, why do you want to leave? And I said, well, I want to get a dog. I want to do my own stuff. I want to go to a movie in the afternoon if I want to. And he's like, you could do that. You can get a dog and bring it to the office. He's like, you could go see a movie if you want to see a movie. I'm like, so he said, I know what you want to do. So I'm happy for you. And he was happy for me. And, you know, I think I had him for another year or two before he died. Very sadly, you know, where I would go and have lunch with him and he would ask me about what I was working on. And he was thrilled that I was doing one project. He was great. And so it was a nice logical progression, I think, to go do that. I mean, he knew that I wanted to do it. He knew I was interested in it. And he had done the same thing, right? So I'm glad he made me feel good about it because it could have happened another way. And I think often does in decorating.
Right. You know, and it sounds like, you know, that really speaks to the type of mentor that he was.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you feel that you think about mentorship with your own team in a similar way? I would assume that had a big influence on you. I know you've had quite a few successful designers come through your office who have gone on to achieve wonderful things on their own, including Suisel and Anne from Tilton Fenwick and Ashley Whitaker.
Suisel, she was one of the best, most intelligent, most creative people I've ever worked with. She was terrific. And I was so happy to see her go out and do her own thing in such an original way. And yes, I mean, that's not something I really think about. I probably could. Mm-hmm. You know, I try to tell employees, you know, the things that Mark did for me, go look up Madeline Castang and, you know, figure that out and shop for me for some lamp that you think would work in one of her things, you know, he would say to me. And so I think those are highly mm-hmm. instructive things that you can pass on to someone looking at the past in order to help you navigate the future. I mean, that was very big for him. It's big for me, looking at all the greats, you know, before. I was always cognizant of how great he was to me, but perhaps after the fact. I maybe should think about that more, but, you know, I think we're all happy for each other, happy to do our own things. Like, nobody expects someone to stay in your office forever and do everything for you. It's just not the way that life goes.
Right. Absolutely. Well, yeah, I would imagine, I don't have children, but I would think it's similar to having children and wanting them to learn and flourish and eventually, you know, leave the nest and go do their own thing. And there's a sense of pride in that.
That's a good analogy.
So let's talk about your style a little bit. One of the things that I find most striking about your work is that you have such a deft ability to work in a variety of styles. While I can usually pinpoint when an interior is yours, if I'm flipping through a magazine, I can often tell if it's a Markham room, but they're, you know, to your credit, each home really has a distinct personality. Do you feel that you have a signature style? And if so, how would you describe it?
Well, thank you, first of all. I try very hard not to have a signature look to imprint on clients. Sure, there are things that I gravitate toward. You know, for example, you can use a fabric that you love in many different ways in many different rooms. So I think that there probably are, you know, ties, but I try very hard to focus on the specifics and make each job different. You know, I want to work on all types of projects, you know, to hold my interest. And the specific aspects of each particular job are what draw me in and keep me sort of focused and happy. You know, I think about this a lot. I'm not sort of, you know, trying to create a line of furniture that speaks to my aesthetic or things like that, that I would then have to go out and sell, et cetera. I'm really interested in working again on each specific project with each client and designing something, you know, for them that works in that specific room. And I'm lucky I get to work all over for the, you know, and the United States and Europe and the islands and things. And I get to work with all different types of people. And again, that holds my interest. There's nothing more fun than working on a house and, you know, thinking about the garden and the family and the kids and the dog and everything. So I hope I don't have a signature look. I try not to. I'm kind of proud of the fact that things don't all look alike, I guess. I have three mm-hmm. clients in the same city in Nashville, and I've worked on all their houses there, and they all go to the same place to ski in Montana, and I've done all their houses there, and they're friends, and the houses are not far from each other. And so I remember at the beginning thinking, holy shit, what am I going to do? I've got to really make this, you know, I've really, really got to pay attention on this one. And, you know, the end result is that all three houses are very different, but they all very much reflect the specific clients. And that was fun. And I, you know, that for me is like a little, I don't know if you call it a badge of honor or whatever. That for me makes me feel good, makes me smile.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a huge coup, especially because they're all friends, and then to have houses in two same cities and likely to have somewhat similar taste if they all hire you.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
You know, that would be a, like, it's one thing if one of them hired you and then someone hired Vincent Wolfe and another person hired like Jamie Drake. That's three very different points of view. But for them all to choose the same decorator, kudos to you to be able to create six different houses for these three clients that each, you know, had their own personality and spoke to not only the sense of place, but the client.
Thanks.
What are some of the emblematic markers of your particular eye? Even if you don't have, let's say, a signature style, how does a room become imbued with Markham
That's
Roberts?
That's a compliment. I'll take that. Mark Thank you.
Markham Roberts' eye and point of view.
You know, I'm not totally sure how to answer that question. As you know, it can be sort of interpreted in different ways or answered in different directions. But sort of one thing that my eye sees or thinks about, my mind thinks about, I like to look at pattern, and I like to look at how it plays and reads in a room, how it makes you feel. I remember a long time ago, you know, at Mark's office, you know, he showed me pictures of the Wrightsman's house in Palm Beach. And that beautiful room done by Stefan Boudin and later Denningham Fourcade, you know, with the chinoiserie paper and that beautiful carpet and all the French furniture in, it's a Brunswick material. The name is eluding me at the moment. But it's a very specific pattern. And the way this pattern was used on all of this furniture to highlight the specific shape of the chair or the specific arm of the sofa, I thought, God, that is just really, really, really thought out and beautiful. And then I thought about how this room has so much going on with all the pattern in the walls and the floor in that carpet, and then all these different fabrics, including the one that was used in the way that I spoke about. I thought, wow, this room should be so busy it makes you dizzy, and yet it was not that at all. And so, you know, I'm interested in things like, There's a bedroom in my book where all of the fabrics are these tiny, all over sort of intricate designs. And, you know, you look at that and think your head's going to spin if you think of it in terms of a larger room. But in actuality, all of these complex patterns can work together to actually soothe your eye in a weird way.
Is this the blue and white bedroom?
Exactly. It can also be super subtle, right? It can also be unconscious, like I talked about before. There's a dining room in this house on Nantucket where I use this very simple, subtle ticking, but in the way that we upholstered the walls with this ticking and the play of different direction of the stripes, I created this paneling. And it's a very subtle thing. You don't notice it right away when you walk in the room. And then it sort of starts to read and you start to apply it to the pattern of the ceiling, the pattern of the floor. You see the pattern echoed in the trim on the curtains, the trim on the, you know, slip covers, and it all works together harmoniously, but it's a super interesting study in what your eye reads and what it doesn't. And so I think that's something that I always think about, whether it's a room that's completely, you know, monochromatic and almost, you know, entirely made of solid, you know, materials and, or, you know, curtain material, a carpet, rug, walls, etc. All of that can work beautifully. And if it is so plain, you know, then I think about the texture and how that reads. So that may be what, I don't know if that's what you were getting at with the question, but that's sort of what popped into my mind.
Well, I think that's an excellent answer. And honestly, as I've gone through your books and I have gone back to them repeatedly, even the new one, I feel like I've gone through many, many times, because each time that I flip through, there's a new detail that I pick up on. And I will say that's one of the things to me that is so amazing about your work is the impeccable level of detail. No detail is overlooked. And when I go back, I'll notice something interesting that you did with the upholstery on a chair, or there's a detail on a leg, or the trim that you used in a way that I hadn't seen before. You know, that I think is obviously such a marker of your aesthetic and your talent as a designer.
Wow, thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit about your design process since you are so detailed? Where do you like to begin?
I like to just phone it in. I talk about it in my first book, sort of the process, and I laid it out in the chapters. Mm-hmm. You know, once you get a read of the client and what I call their hopes and dreams, right? You know, by discussing things with them, looking at where they live now, what they like about it, what they don't like about it. Once you get sort of a handle or a grasp on the clients and the parameters of the project, you know, I approach it, I think, very much like Mark did, because that's how I was trained. But I begin with the furniture plan. And that to me speaks to the function of the room, which is the most important thing to think about, I think, initially, because anything you do decorating wise needs to fall in line with that. I move to the scheme and the color palette after that. And then I, you know, select the furnishings. And, you know, that's making the upholstery, making the curtains, you know, selecting end tables and lamps and things. And then, you know, you do that final part of artwork and accessories and things that make a room come alive.
Right. Do you like to present everything all at once to your clients, or do you break it up into different
stages? Well, I think you can't unless you have an extraordinarily long time frame, which nobody has. Nobody's willing to wait mm-hmm. for anything ever, right? unless you have a really long period of time and carte blanche to buy whatever you want and put it in storage whenever you see it, you can't do it that way. You present the clients with the furniture plan and the scheme overall and the upholstery styles and a really good picture of the room. And then you work on, you know, the finishing the details of finding those end tables that you want, or the lamps, or working out the lamp shades once you find the lamps. And it all mm-hmm. sort of unfolds and layers on top of, you know, the basic design that you're able to show in the beginning. But there's no way to do that sort of complete a picture all in the beginning unless you have, you know, all the freedom in the world and all the time in the world.
Right. Yeah, that would be a mammoth undertaking. What do you find is most integral to creating a successful interior?
Okay. I think that rational thought and clear communication are the most important things to get a client through from the beginning to the end happily. It's super easy to come up with a beautiful design, but if you can't implement it and you can't realize it, it doesn't get appreciated in the end, right? And then clients don't mm-hmm. you know, want to hire you again or want to tell their friends to hire you. I mean, it's all about communication. And I think that's true in life and probably in any job. Decorating is a little bit more difficult because there are, again, as you said before, so many things that can go wrong when you're planning something. There are all sorts of different things to think about, but you really have to be as clear as you can with clients and help them through the process, which makes them happy. And that, you know, clients' happiness is the success of an interior. No matter how much I want something to look one way or another, it doesn't matter. That doesn't apply. It's not my house. And mm-hmm. So that's sort of how I think about that.
I think that's a great perspective and a good reminder. As a matter of fact, to that point, in your new book, Notes on Decorating, which was just published and recently released, you mentioned in the introduction the complexity of decorating as a business. And you go on to say, our job is to help our clients achieve a result that will give them immense pleasure. Yet with all of the intricacies of different minds looking at the same thing, we run the risk of getting the opposite reaction from the one we intended disappointment. I know that these sentiments must ring true for every decorator out there. They certainly do for me. How do you go about the business of ensuring that your clients end up loving what you present? And do you feel like it's a little bit of a push and pull situation?
It can be. Sure, it can be. It depends on the client. But look, if you're interested and enthusiastic about something, approaching it, it's likely that your client who's coming with you along for the ride will be interested and enthusiastic about it. I try very hard to have a good time doing it. and not to take myself mm-hmm. too seriously. I don't tend to choose to work with clients who take themselves too seriously. It's decorating. It's not brain surgery. And, you know, we're lucky to be doing it. And, you know, I want to show clients that I'm mindful of their concerns always. I want to show them that I'm listening to them, that I'm thinking about all the things we discussed as their desired outcomes. I want to talk them through the process of why I think one thing is important versus another, or something's awful and will never work, you know, whatever it is that comes up along the process. I want to really, I guess, be there for them, so that we can get through it, you know, so that we can, navigate all of the submerged rocks in this lake that we have to get through. so that's that.
Yeah, I think it's so true. And I've heard that from so many people that I've spoken to for the podcast. I think one of the common things that I often hear is, first and foremost, like you said, not to take oneself too seriously. And I say this in my office all the time too. You know, things happen. There are mistakes. There are back orders. Things go wrong. We will figure it out. We will get it figured out. Thankfully, mm-hmm. it's decorating. And while we run a serious business and take our responsibility to our clients very seriously, it's not organ transplantation. No one's life is on the line. It will get figured out. And then also, you know, to your other point, I think having conviction and confidence is important too. You know, your clients are coming to you to be the expert, and because hopefully they love your work and they love your taste. And, you know, if you're presenting things to them that you're truly passionate about in terms of that being the right choice for that particular house and the vision that you've come up with together, then hopefully you're not facing an uphill battle to
right. The other aspect of the last thing that you said is that if you do not know about something, don't pretend that you do. Always be honest with your client. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if people ask me questions about tech things, I'm like, I'm the last person that you want to ask that question to. I can pick out how this should look, and I can create something to house the control for this or whatever it is. But let's go to the experts on this and let's get the information that we need in order to make an informed decision.
Yes. That's so true. Well, and speaking about your book, your first book, Decorating the Way I See It, was published in 2014. And as I mentioned, Notes on Decorating was just released earlier this month. Could you tell us a little bit about where this new book picks up from where the last one left off?
So it, too, is sort of an examination of the way that I think about work or think about projects. So they have that in common. This one, you know, the first one deals with kind of the basics, the furniture plan, the scheme, things like that. This one goes a little bit into more detail on subjects, things like, you know, sense of place or the client's point of view. We talked about my first chapter is client's point of view. And we talked about, you know, gleaning from the client their hopes and dreams and figuring out what they want. And that's the most important thing, I think, to start the process, so that the end result does, in fact, look like very much like the client. I talk about a sense of place in that, you know, that a house in the mountains is very different from a house, you know, at the beach or in a sort of polished urban environment. And for me, a sense of appropriateness that isn't rigid or anything like that, but, you know, you kind of want to think in terms of, you know, what's going to work in a house in the woods, you know, stone and natural materials versus a high-rise penthouse, you know, overlooking some urban view. I talk about practicality as a chapter, which is something that most people think decorators never think of or don't even know what the word means. But it is the one of the most important things that you can think about. And it really does, you know, practicality, people think a lot of times they'll just think, oh, well, that means like, you know, saving money and thinking of a cost-effective way. And it can mean that, because that can make something happen easier than something wildly expensive, maybe. But you have to think about little kids and, you know, dripping ice cream and the materials that you would choose for that. You have to think about how a desk is going to function in a room, what it needs to hold, et cetera. And so practicality is, you know, utmost on my mind whenever thinking about a whole project, a specific room, or a specific piece of furniture. There's one chapter in the book devoted to a house on Nantucket, a really fun project that I did that took a long time. I didn't want to work on it when it first came to me, and I didn't think I did. And the client was so great, and she convinced me to do it. And it ended up being one of the most gratifying projects I've ever worked on. One of the most interesting things with a client who, incredibly knowledgeable, had the most beautiful collections of things, and was willing to indulge, like truly, truly indulge my creativity. And I think the last chapter deals with something called the evolution of a house. And it focuses on James's and my house out on Puget Sound in Washington State, and how the house has completely evolved over the years, and how, you know, that can make a house better. Life changes, mm-hmm. circumstances changes, and our environments should adapt to those changes. And, you know, the more thought and time you can put into something, the better it will be for you. And that house for us is just, it's our little slice of heaven. I mean, we can't wait to get there, and we dread leaving, and we don't get to spend enough time there, but hopefully more and more we will. So this book, again, just to wrap it up, sorry, it's a continuation of my thought process, and it showcases, you know, my work like the first one did. These books are a decorator's ability to show off, right? Mm-hmm. It's fun. It's fun doing them.
Well, speaking of fun, I have to ask you about your travel manifesto or writer that you put in the introduction. I was cracking up. What made you want to do
that?
Well,
whenever I am contacted by a client I don't know, I've never met before, we don't have a friend in common or something, and I'm going to a city to stay with them to look at their house to see if I want to work on this project, you know, they always, the initial emails are very polite and nice, et cetera. And they always ask me, you know, sort of what I need if I'm going to be spending the night or whatever. And so I'll send this just to see how they react to it, because it's, you know, it's just a good sign of like, let's loosen up and have a good time. I mean, it's quite silly, but it's nice. And it does, it lets a client know that I'm not some, you know, deadly serious, boring person, or I don't know. I mean, they're deadly serious people who are not boring at all. That's not what I meant to say. But it lets a client know that I don't take myself too seriously, which I think is important to convey early on. And it just puts everyone at ease. So that's why that's in there. And it is fun to send, because just get hilarious reactions to it.
Oh, I'm sure it's such a great icebreaker. That's so fun. Well, Markham, you're approaching your 25th year in business, which is quite an accomplishment, quite a milestone. What stands out to you most when you think back on the last few decades working as a decorator?
You know, the thing that strikes me most is just how fast time flies and how much quicker it goes. You wouldn't know this, the older one gets.
I know.
not yet. So, in some ways, it feels like yesterday that I was just setting up my business in the beginning with two employees, and I, you know, I had all of this enthusiasm that was yet uncrushed by life, or whatever. I'm joking. But other times it feels like, you know, it's been eons. The nature of our job is always looking ahead, you know, to plan things, to figure things out. And so things go really quickly. And I have to say, one really nice thing about doing this book and the last one was that when you get all these pictures together and you're working on the layout, you have this sort of collective reminder of all of this that you've done. And, you know, it's a nice moment of, I guess, self awareness and maybe pride in, wow, you know, God, I've worked really hard. I've been doing this a long time. Like, I got to do this and this and this. It's a very nice feeling that you lose track of, you know, given our everyday rush, 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 rush through things. So that mm-hmm. stands out the most to me is just how quickly it's gone.
That's amazing. Well, congratulations. That's such a big coup. And you obviously have such an incredible body of work to look back on. So what are you currently working on that you're most excited about? If we look forward instead of looking back.
It's good to look forward. I'm having fun right now. We're joining two townhouses on the Upper East Side and joining the gardens. And it's kind of exciting. It's not something that we get to do in New York all the time. And it's quite fun. I like all the stuff that I work on. I won't take on something unless I think it's going to be fun or interesting or whatever. I'm working on a new project down in Tribeca in one of these, you know, super tall, minimalist, sleek, high-rise buildings. And it's like completely modern and pared down and curved windows. And it's so high up that I get dizzy when I go close to the window. But the views are so beautiful. I've never seen anything like it in any apartment in the city. The way it's situated down in Tribeca, it's just beautiful. I'm working on a bunch of things in Tennessee and in both Nashville and Memphis, which are fun with clients that I really, really like, and a new client who I think seems great. Maybe the most exciting thing that I'm working on right now would have to be a beautiful, important historic house in London. It's on one of those fancy squares in Belgravia. And it's a complete mm-hmm. sort of gut renovation and restoration of this house. And that's all I can say about it, but it's super exciting to work.
So. Oh, how wonderful. That's all so exciting. It sounds like we have a lot to look forward to.
God, kill me.
That's another thing I don't think people realize is just how much work it is to put a book together. It's a labor of love.
It is another full-time job on top of a full-time job that we have, but it is worth it. It is gratifying. It's just a lot. You're, as you said, a lot of work.
Markham, is there anything that people might be surprised to learn about you?
You know, I don't think so. I don't think there's anything about me that's much of a mystery. I don't really even know how to answer that. I hate smoked salmon. I have to say I hate smoked salmon. So maybe that's a surprise. Do you remember there used to be a show on television called Fear Factor? I mean, it was just a terrible show. It was one of those game shows.
Yes.
James and I were watching it once, and you go up to some table and they offer you boiled intestines of some goat or like a vile caterpillar from the Amazon or something repulsive. And I looked at James and I said, if there were smoked salmon on the table, I would be like, okay, well, I give up. You can keep the money. I give up. I lose. There's anything. I can't think of anything. You know, I'm pretty typical, I suppose.
That's so funny. Well, you're an open book then, aside from the smoked salmon. Yeah. Now everybody knows not to serve you smoked salmon.
Please, no.
If you could go back in time, is there a piece of advice that you would give your younger self?
I would say, much to what we were speaking about before, slow down and enjoy the moment or every moment or whatever that cliche is. But it's true, you know, time flies and every birthday is a blessing, I guess you could think of it with your health. You have to think, take nothing for granted, but slow down and enjoy it. Again, like we're always rushing and things get faster and faster with cell phones and the internet and all of that. It's really important to try. And COVID has been, I think, good in some way because it's actually stopped us in time a little bit or in place a little bit. And, mm-hmm. refocused our attention on things. I've never been at our house here for that stretch of time uninterrupted, and to see the garden change in real time was great. So my younger self who was always, you know, looking forward and rushing ahead, et cetera, I would tell myself to slow down and also maybe calm down a little bit. Like, I'm such an alarmist in life. You know, I watched as a little boy 60 Minutes with my parents and I thought the world would end every week. And so you need to focus on what you can control and what you can do, and not let everything come in and weigh it on you. That's my advice.
Great reminder. I think that's a fantastic answer. Well, as we wind down and wrap up, I'll ask you one last question. What is currently giving you hope in the world of design or otherwise?
It's a difficult time right now. We were discussing this before. COVID has all of its difficulties and changes. You know, the world is, you look at the news, you see wildfires and hurricanes and political fighting and danger in the world. And it's like really like a Debbie Downer time, right? I mean, there's a lot going on. But I try not to lose sight of the good things. And for me, I think those are some of the simpler things, like my dog and the garden, as I said, and, you know, being in the house and really getting to spend time there. Certainly friends and family and connecting to those things. Those are important to me. And make me feel better and make me feel, you know, they put a smile on my face. Music for me is super important. Music can change my mood instantly. So I've been listening to a lot of music. I wish I had more time to read. That always brings pleasure. And design is always a fun thing for me. I mean, I don't mean to say that this job is not full of, you know, wild irritation and hassle, et cetera, and drama and, you know, whatever goes on with any job, but design is always fun. Getting to do something and create something and being able to express your artistic interest or creative interest is the most gratifying and uplifting thing. So I feel very, very lucky to be doing what I'm doing and not have it be interrupted in a time when so many people's lives have been, you know, altered so drastically. So I kind of Debbie Downered a little bit, but I'm trying to make it positive at the end. Okay, good.
You made it very positive. Yes. No, I mean, there's no escaping the fact that it is a scary time and there's so much to be concerned about. And every time you turn on the news, it feels like the world is coming to an end. But I think to your point, it's so much about taking this opportunity to find the positive, to find the silver linings, to, you know, sort of figure out what really matters in life, because it's given us all sort of an opportunity to reset and refocus and reframe the way that we spend our time and our energy. So I completely agree with you. I think that your perspective is the best that it can be. You know, you've really figured out what matters most to you. And I think that that will obviously impact you, and for each of us, you know, the new perspective that we've gained as a result will impact the way that we move forward in the future.
That is key. I think it's life is always creating balances, et cetera, but this is giving us an opportunity to make things work better, work more smoothly. So it's food for everyone to think about.
Totally. Well, Markham, I can't thank you enough. I've absolutely loved chatting with you, getting to know more about you, and you've been such a delight. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's nice to talk to you.
Of course. I hope to see you soon.
Thanks.
Take good care. That was interior designer and author Markham Roberts. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Be sure to visit us online at palomacontreras.com under the podcast tab, where you can find more episodes featuring inspiring conversations with creatives. You can listen directly on our website or subscribe via Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're enjoying the Style Files, please consider spreading the word and leaving us a positive rating or review. It will only take a few seconds of your time and will make a big difference for us. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.